following is a presentation of Foosball Radio. It's Foos Talk Live.
Are you talking to me?
Compelling and lively banter.
Are you going to talk to us?
Talking foosball.
Foosball was how I measured my value as a man. You took that away.
Players and fans, promoters and pros. Unedited and raw.
Talk.
Living in the moment.
We have a lot of important things to talk about.
All while practicing social distancing.
Cool. We'll talk. No big whoop.
Let's get this thing started. Foos Talk Live.
Hi, I'm Tom Robinson, and I want to personally thank our Patreon pillars for their support of Foosball Radio. That includes James Sparky Castillo, Craig Topham, Christina Fuchs, Carl Fleischer, Jay Teal, David Kalla, Brian Schmid, Cameron Burrows, Mike Green, Jimmy Love, Dwayne Stewart, Judy Schober, Jamie Kunst, Rob Cutler, Reed Rector, Adam Gilson, and our friends from the 716 Buffalo Foosball Club. Thank you. Your support brings continued and expanding content from Foosball Radio as we cover the greatest sport on earth. Visit patreon.com/foosballradio to find out how to become a Foosball Radio patron. Learn more about the exclusive benefits we offer you. Foos Talk Live is brought to you by Original Leonhardt. The Leonhardt Tournament Model is the most popular foosball table at the ITSF World Cup. Designed and handcrafted in Germany. Order online and have it delivered to your door. Visit www.original-leonhardt-usa.com and use promo code FOOSTALK to save 10% off your purchase price. Happy Memorial Day weekend 2023. Hey there, I'm Tom Robinson. It's another episode of Foos Talk Live. This one, episode number 160. And of course, we are celebrating Memorial Day weekend with two features this weekend. First of all, coming up tonight on the Player Spotlight, we have none other than Terry Moore joining us later on. Mike Green, of course, is going to co-host later on, but we'll be hearing from Terry Moore, the legendary player. Lots of things happening with those guys. We'll be getting to that in just a bit. But first of all, this weekend is also the 2023 Texas State Championships in Dallas, Texas. And as you may have already noticed, yeah, Jim Stevens, Adam Gilson are hanging out there. It looks like a very fancy broadcast booth there, guys. What's up?
Yeah, this is our broadcast booth here, Tom. And right down there is table number one. No, actually, we're here in the studios that have been provided to Adam by this beautiful Marriott Hotel. And it is a really, really nice hotel. Great venue for a tournament. A tournament that is considered the longest running tournament probably in the entire world of foosball.
Yeah.
I was talking to Adam earlier about how this is, for me, my first Texas State Championships was 29 years ago, 1994.
29.
And I think I've worked something You're like old. 24, 25 of them for the great Steve Murray. And this one's no different. Great competition, a great players environment, great hotel. You know, Steve Murray, the Hall of Famer, you know, one of the great foosball men of all time, doing a great job once again this year.
Just wanted to show you this. Can you see it?
Mm-hmm. There it is.
Yeah. Texas State. Yeah,
there An is. Official right. Texas State foosball.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's it.
That was I think it says 2018, but I was there in 2021, but still got my Texas State
stencil. Change it.
Mm-hmm. What up, Adam?
Well, you know, to speak to what Jim's saying, the showmanship of Steve Murray is on show at these events. And he always doesn't let anybody in until 3 or 4 the opening day, yeah. Right? And you walk into the ballroom and everything is just immaculate and amazing, and there's mm-hmm. chandeliers and there's just music, and it's part of what makes it so mm-hmm. special. I've only been to two, unfortunately. I wish I'd been to more, but I've only been to two. But every single one that I've been to, it's pretty memorable, and that's by design.
It is, and you know, generally it's 90, 95 degrees with 90% humidity outside. You come in the ballroom and it's literally about 62 degrees. They keep Ooh. The air conditioning on very high, thus the jacket that I constantly wear here. but again, you know, Steve Murray, when you're putting together the short list of the greatest foosball men in the history of American table soccer, he is going to be on that short list, no question about it, as a player, as a promoter, as an executive. And a guy that when you come to a Steve Murray tournament, you know you're going to be treated well. You know the conditions are going to be first rate, and they are this year as well with the pit area. With seating on both sides, we are actually in our booth set up at one end of it. So we're a little detached from table number one, but the viewing is fantastic, and the environment certainly reflective of that as well.
Well, I got to know, first of all, what's the action like this weekend? Are you guys seeing some amazing matches or what?
Oh, yeah. No, for sure. You know, again, the competition, this is a major championship. It's, you know, you get the way we determine what a major championship is. There's a couple of things. It's the level of competition, you know, who comes. Most of the top players are here this weekend. It's the history of the event. It's the number of players in attendance. And Texas State checks all three boxes there. This is a major championship. And so you do see tremendous competition. You see tremendous matches. We've seen some really good ones, including the mixed doubles final, which we'll get to here in a minute, which was a really, really good match. The
yes.
women's doubles winner's bracket final was a heck of a match. That went down 8-7, I think, in the third game.
Wow.
And these days, Tom, women's events are some of the more entertaining. It hasn't always been the case, not to be a misogynist or anything at all.
Oh, no.
But sometimes the women's events in the past, you know, a two-hour final where scoring is difficult because they're very good defensively. Not anymore. The ladies these days, we've never seen a better crop of lady players than we have right now. And that was certainly obvious in that winner's bracket final. And we can touch on that here in a minute as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, and matches aside, there's a vacuum this weekend. And I'm not talking about the kind that cleans the floor that I need when I spilled all my pretzels. We're talking about Tony Spraderman is not here. And when that vacuum is created, you know, we're going to be seeing who's filling it this weekend. And that there's a lot of stories there to be looking at and talking about. Obviously, I love seeing all the local players come out at these things. There's so much passion and so much love for this tournament. Unlike anything else I experienced in foosball.
Wow.
Yeah, I think you could say Colorado State has a similar thing, but it's only been around 10 or 12 years. Yeah. This one has been around better than 30 years. And again, there is such a respect, and it's something that Steve Murray has built over the years. Yesterday, we had a chance to watch the Open Singles competition, and I think that's where the vacuum, the Tony Spraderman vacuum is most obvious. Because Tony, the greatest singles player perhaps in the history of the world, period, not here this weekend, which kind of opens it up. Generally, if you're going to be placing a bet on this event, it's Tony Spraderman or the field, right? And so while Ryan Moore is here, although he got beat by Kevin Romero in a semifinal in the winner's bracket in three straight games in about 15 minutes. Kevin played great. So it is. Who does it open up, you know, the title for? Tommy Yore is here. Tommy Yore making a comeback. He and Kevin Romero will actually play in the winner's bracket final, I think, a little later tonight. And you can watch that, of course, at InsideFoos.com or at the Foosball Sports Network on Twitch. But that's going to be a good one. Who's it going to be? Is it going to be Ryan Moore? Is he going to be motivated enough? Is it going to be Kevin Romero really responding after a difficult Las Vegas tournament? Is it going to be Tommy Yore, who won this title 2 years ago, the last time he was here? Or is it going to be someone else? And certainly, that's what makes it interesting. Yes, we miss Tony. Tony is a big presence at these things. Great guy, great player, all-time great player. But it's now makes it interesting, doesn't it, Adam, as to who will come out on top specifically in singles?
Yep, absolutely. And whenever we see that, this turnover, whenever Billy Pappas leaves, when he left and quit playing regularly on tour, or Collignon, it changes. It opens up different venues, different things to happen. And this is what we're getting to see. And it's kind of exciting. It's kind of exciting to watch. I'm looking forward to seeing that finals, the winner's bracket finals, not till later. And what are they're working through open doubles right now.
They are. And open doubles is a little different this year, Tom. It's Swiss system in open doubles.
It is.
And this is kind of, we've been talking, and you know this, for two or three years now about how the Swiss system really moving forward, it needs to be the future of foosball here
right.
in this country. And so today, there were five qualifying rounds in open doubles, and then that's going to create an elimination bracket, which should go pretty quick. We should be down to the finals tonight, I would think, for open doubles as well. And there's some really interesting pairings in that doubles event.
Yeah, it's a great format. It seems like, especially with people who never get an opportunity to play with the top pros, here's your chance. You know, this is such a cool idea, and makes it much more interesting down the line.
It does, and honestly, this you might think I'm being facetious here, but I mean it. Like, if I'm an up and coming player and I'm just trying to like get better, and I get destroyed in five matches by good players, I would take way more from that than say You know, going out in two, mm-hmm. You just
every
time. There's no way. I mean, I'm sure there's the chart that would show you how much more. The more you play and the more you lose, the better you get eventually. Yeah. It's just the time frame that gets compressed when you do it this way, which is great. So, you know, I'm looking forward to it. I'm curious to see how, because I haven't looked at that. Looking at Modern Foosball, if you go check out, it shows you the layout of who, you know, who's won four, who's won five, and so on and so forth. And that's how they're going to see that. I mean, we don't know if it's 16 or 32 teams in the elimination brackets.
Sometimes it's only eight even. But what this does, I think, in the big picture more than anything, Tom, is it begins the process of moving towards that Swiss system. Someone has to take the chance to do it, right? Promoters are always so worried, well, if I change the format, will people show up? Will I be able to liquidate my tournament? Will I be able to at least break even on it? And that's a whole other topic, whether or not tournaments should be supported by entry fees alone. That's a topic for another day. Mm. But what it does is begin the conversation about this. It allows players to experience this Swiss system, word of mouth. They kind of and allow Steve Murray and the promoters of this event to kind of see what the reaction is to it. And we know what the reaction will be. We know it's going to be positive. But it begins the process, the necessary process of moving towards that system.
I think that there's nothing but to be gained, but good stuff. You know, I think it's going to be it's going to be an evolution, of course, and they're going to work the bugs out. But I think that's going to be a standard for the future, no doubt.
For sure. And apparently, I just got a message saying that the Yor versus Romero winners bracket finals coming up here on table number one. It's been called, and we're going to go down and do that here as soon as we're done here. But you know, again, this is a special tournament. It is it's Steve Murray's baby, mm-hmm. a man who has meant so much to the sport over the years, and you know, so much tradition to this event and great competition. And so I do, you know, advise people to tune in and watch the last day or two. This tournament does go through tomorrow at InsideFoos.com.
If we could just touch briefly on the Texas Legends ceremony tonight, which is underway as of 8 o'clock Central, 9 p.m. Eastern, which is the same time as Foos Talk Live. But, Jim, are you going to be the MC tonight?
I am. And Steve Murray has asked me specifically to not say anything, not to laud his accomplishments, not to talk nicely about him, not to say a word about Steve Murray. And you know, Tom, that's not going to be the case.
Of course, we're
going to talk about Steve. And generally, Steve, in fact, not generally, every single year, Steve sheds a tear or two at this ceremony. Two individuals going in. No one knows yet who they are except a couple of us. They don't even know that they're going in. That's going to be exciting.
That's a closely guarded secret, correct?
It is.
Wow. So, yeah, you hope that they're there.
They're here.
All right. That's really,
they're here. I've said hi to them several times.
And, good.
They're completely oblivious to the fact that later tonight they're going to get a really nice surprise.
Is it me? You've said hi to me a lot.
I said hi.
Dang it. Oh, there it is. I cracked the code.
Yeah.
That's going to be exciting. I love that. I love the Hall of Fame ceremonies at tournaments, whatever size it is. It's just so nice to just, you get a chance to really celebrate the regional player base.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just so fun. It's so moving.
Yeah, no, it is. And it's always a pleasure to host the ceremonies of this sort. And it's as my career has reached maybe towards the twilight years, this is something I really enjoy, whether it's the Hall of Fame ceremony in Las Vegas, the Colorado Hall of Fame event each year here, the Bardo ceremony. Of course, let's not forget about the Bardo Kern celebration August 17th down at the Kalahari Resort in Austin, Texas. Should be a really special one. As well. So I'm looking forward to getting back out there and commentating some matches tonight.
Cool.
And then on through tomorrow. And when you see Terry Moore, give him our best wishes.
Oh, yeah.
Terry certainly, as a Southern Californian, I watched Terry from day one come up through the system. And I've told the story on the air before where I was in a Draw Your Partner at a place called Yankee Doodles in Long Beach, California, back in the late 1980s.
Yankee Doodles,
and I drew a player, a young player out of San Diego, named Terry Moore, the big guy. Terry, about 6'6" and about 350 pounds. Big guy. And I said, hey, big guy, just hop back there and do the best you can at that stage. 2 years later, he was the best player in the world.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. No one has ever skyrocketed to the top the way he did. No one in the history of the sport has gone from being basically a rookie player to being the best player in the world in about 2 years. And that, of course, that was all documented in the movie Foosballers as well.
Extraordinary. Extraordinary. And Adam?
Oh, before we go, two things. The turnout, what do we...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's eyeballing. I think you can go to Modern Foosball and get an accurate number. I've looked at it, and I'm thinking 350, 375, somewhere in there. You know, this is a state championship, but it isn't. This is a major championship. So you get players not only from the state of Texas, which has such a great foosball tradition, but also from all over the country, probably 20, 30 states represented here this weekend. It's been a good turnout. Everybody having fun. Everybody really enjoying the event this weekend.
And last thing, you see this on the screen?
What is that?
Yeah. I'm getting Kilroy was here vibes. You remember Kilroy?
Is that on your shirt or is that actually
but isn't that funny? It looks like Kilroy was anyway.
He was here.
One quick question. I was watching you guys commentate a match yesterday in open mixed with Brandon Moreland and Ellen Moon versus
Robertson and
Blake Robertson and Liz Hill. What happened in the second set? Because I missed the second set.
Blake continued to really play at a high level for the first game or so, and Liz continued to play consistent foosball throughout. Moreland and Moon kind of came back in that second set, but eventually it was Robertson and Moore, the former world champions, who held on to win. And it was really, really a good match.
Yeah,
Robertson at times was almost superhuman in his ability to get quick, organic reads. I mean, there's never been more of a field player than Blake Robertson.
Wow.
And when he's rolling, when he's creating, he is incredible to watch.
Yeah, it was really, really entertaining to watch. I mean, and it seemed like Brandon was not going to give up. He just kept coming back and kept scoring again. But then it came down to that that second set, and I had to turn it off. But, wow. Well, I wish I'll have to go back and watch the review.
You can go back and watch it live at InsideFoos.com.
Yeah, cool. Awesome. Well, guys, I hope that the rest of the weekend goes well. Congratulations to the Texas Legend winners this weekend. And, guys, any parting shots before you go?
Don't take Sudafed and coffee.
That's a good one. That's not a bad one at all.
Okay.
I guess for me, I just I'm excited that I wish we were going to be there to be able to participate in the interview of Terry Moore. What a great career. What a great player.
Oh, yeah.
Top 10 all-time player and truly a legendary figure in the history of table soccer. So enjoy that.
Cool.
That's what I meant to say. Yeah.
And don't take Sudafed and coffee.
Yeah, see?
That's what I was going to say. Just don't do it. Don't even attempt it. Kids out there watching, don't do it.
Don't do it. Put that in post-production, Tom.
No Sudafed, no coffee. At least at the same time. Yeah. Okay. Understood. Right. Well, guys, thanks for popping over. And wow, great to get caught up with Texas State 2023. And our regards to Steve Murray, old dad. Tell him that I miss him. And that we'll hopefully see him in the very near future. But thanks for popping in on Foos Talk Live.
Thank you, buddy.
And Foos Talk Live is on the air. We are having a few technical issues this evening, so this is not being aired live on Twitch TV as we normally are. But that's okay. We're going to continue on as normal because this is being recorded, and we're going to be able to play it back later for you as a podcast. And you'll also be able to see this as a video too on Twitch TV, so fear not. But it is Memorial Day weekend. We're having a great time so far. Sounds like things are going really well at Texas State 2023. Currently, the Texas Legend ceremony is underway. I have a feeling it's probably going to be the better part of an hour, but a great weekend nonetheless there in Dallas, Texas. But the rest of us are enjoying barbecues and having a great weekend, and of course, remembering our fallen heroes, as we should during the Memorial Day weekend. Which brings me to someone who's not fallen, but is still a hero. That would be Mike Green. Mike, how are you, man?
I'm great. How about yourself, Paul?
Oh, you know, it's other than these technical glitches, I mean, I just keep moving forward. That's it. I mean, I'm not one of those types to just throw in the towel. We're going to do the show regardless. So there you have it. And I'm looking forward to getting a chance to chat with our guest tonight in our player spotlight. So give me an idea, Mike. What's going on with you and the Memorial Day weekend? What do you like to do?
Actually, I'm in, as you can tell, I'm sitting outside.
Love it.
Property in Georgia, and I still live in Florida, obviously, and my wife is an early sleeper, so I figured I better come out here and do this.
I see. Okay.
I've got foosball like on my iPad, on my phone, and my television right now. I just actually watched Isabella and Aveta Moore win women's doubles, double dipping Sully.
Wow, that's amazing. And Sully was teamed up with Hannah. Was that the case this weekend?
No, my goodness, I can't think of the girl's name, and I feel so bad.
Is it Delisa Bombach?
Yes.
Gotcha.
Yes.
Gotcha.
Thank you. It's my old age. Sorry, Tom.
No, that's fine. I saw Delisa and Sully play. It was actually Hannah Smith and Sully's mom, Keisha.
Yeah, and it was a tough match, like overtime match. They went, but
oh yeah, really tough.
But no, we're just hanging out, chilling out in Georgia, and I'm really excited and pumped up about having Terry Moore on. He's definitely one of my favorite all-time players, without a doubt.
Well, I think that that's reason enough to say let's welcome Terry Moore to the Player Spotlight on Foos Talk Live. Terry, welcome to Foos Talk Live.
Hey guys, hey, thanks for the invite. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're very welcome, and thanks for being with us. This is quite the occasion, a great way to celebrate Memorial Day weekend. So, when it comes to Memorial Day weekend, what are you up to? What do you like to do?
I did a cookout with one of my coworkers. We went over to his house, and we cooked up some steak and all the good fixings, and had a nice day.
Oh, very nice. Yeah. What's the weather like where you are?
It's pretty nice today. Actually, mid 80s. A few clouds in the sky, but it's a pretty nice day actually.
Nice. So I know you're from San Diego, California. Is it anything like California there?
No, there's nothing like Southern California weather. You just can't beat it.
So, and just give me an idea. What state are you in? What are you are? Where are you right now?
I live in Northern Mississippi right now.
Oh, Northern Mississippi. Gotcha. God, same state as Hannah Smith.
Yes. She lives. I think she lives down near Jackson. She's about two and a half hours south of me.
Got it. Wow. So give me just let us know, how long have you been in Mississippi and what brought you there?
Well, I've moved out. I relocated here about, I think, 4 years ago next week, actually, for a change of an employer, and got a good deal to live in this part of the country and work for them here. So often moved out from Galveston, California for about 7 or 8 years and ended up moving out here.
Excellent. Outstanding. So, you know, give us an idea what's been happening for you. Well, when it comes to currently, when it comes to foosball, when was the last time you got on a table to compete?
Oh, shit. The last time I actually played in the tournament was probably maybe a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago. I think I popped into the Georgia State and played a couple of events there. But prior to that, it had been maybe a year or two before that. I mean, I've played a little draw your partners or something here and there once in a while with some friends and family, but for the most part, I haven't really competed in the last like 15 years.
Now, we recently spoke to Doug Furry, and Doug Furry has not played in 30 some odd years.
He's got me smoked.
Right. I mean, to be as at the top of the field the way the both of you have been, I find it surprising because, I mean, I'm 64 and I still love playing every week. I just can't get enough. Of course, it's a different situation. I was never a competitor. But, yeah, that's good to hear. At least you still like to get on the table on occasion.
Yeah, I still enjoy the game. I mean, obviously, you know, it's something that I'm never not going to enjoy or love the game. It's just, for me, it was a matter of just competitiveness, and I'm super competitive, and you know, when I was getting later in my career, you lose a little bit of the drive because I don't see how some of the guys that continue to play and are successful keep doing it, because for me it just got more painful to lose than it did to win.
Understood. So understood.
Yeah.
Well, traditionally speaking, here on Foos Talk Live, and Mike, if you'll forgive me, but one of the things we always want to do, especially with people like yourself, we want to find out your origins. So, what was the first time you saw a foosball table? How old were you, and what kind of table was it?
So, the first time I saw a foosball table was probably, I probably was about 14 years old, 13 or 14 years old.
Okay.
And I was a video game, an arcade junkie kid, right?
Uh-huh.
And loved my video games. But the arcade I played at had two of the old glass top Tornado tables in it.
Mm-hmm.
This would have been probably back in, I want to say early 80s, maybe 82, 81. And all the older kids on Friday and Saturday nights would play foosball. You know, there'd be a big group of older teenagers playing on the foosball tables. And grant you, this was an arcade that had no knowledge of professional style play, you know. Mm-hmm. It was just like challenge tables with, you know, people doing razzle dazzle type stuff. No spins, obviously, but no rules or structures, no passing.
Right.
Set shots were pretty much unknown. So, you know, just growing older and wanting to be doing what the older kids did at the time, I started playing at my local arcade, and my best friend, we both got hooked into it. And, then I think when I got to be 16, and this was all in San Diego. Mm. When I got to be 16 and got my driver's license, I had heard about a tournament that was being run by Evan Stachulik over at San Diego State University, about a 15-minute drive away from me.
Okay.
And so me and my best friend, we drove over on a Sunday night, not on tournament night, which was Friday nights back then. We didn't want to, you know, we didn't know what we were getting into, so we wanted to kind of check it out. And so we went in there, and it was on a different table with Dynamo, obviously, back then. And this would have been probably 85, maybe 84.
Sure.
I got my license when I was 84. So yeah, probably about 84. And there was two guys in there playing on the Dynamos that they had in there. And me and my buddy just kind of watched them for a while. And, you know, these guys were doing passing structure, set shots, mm-hmm. moving defenses, stuff like that. And we're looking at these guys and like thinking, because we had gotten to be kind of the best of our arcade, you know.
Oh yeah,
group of arcade players, we were kind of the best of that.
Outgrew that.
And we look at these guys and we're like, holy cow, like this is these guys are world champions. And they were just, you know, in ranking standards, they were probably, you know, back then I think it was rookies and experts. Mm-hmm. They might have been rookies or low experts. But to my view, they were the best players ever. And
right.
I just kind of, from that point on, I was like, I gotta get good at this, you know? And so I started going to the Sunday night. I think it was a Friday night tournament or Sunday, I remember it was Sunday night, but I used to go to the tournament, and, you know, obviously I was the guy, I think, that nobody ever wanted to get.
Oh, really? So you were one of those guys?
Oh yeah, I was one of those guys. You definitely, if you drew me, you knew you were going out in two, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah.
From there, you know, it just kind of grew from there. I just got the bug. I ended up trading in my. I had bought my own glass top Tornado from one of the local players there who was trying to get a Dynamo because he was trying to play on the tour table, and
mm-hmm.
you know, played with that for a while, and then I got the bug myself, and I ended up swapping out with a local arcade for a Dynamo for my glass top, and I got my own Dynamo, and then, you know, kind of grew from there.
That's when things really get serious, when you get your own table.
Yeah, I got my own table. Then I was actually, it's weird. So I, you know, I got the bug. I was going playing. I got to be friends with all the local players. Back then we had, you know, Evan playing weekly. His brother Eden would make appearances.
Mm.
We'd even have some of the LA guys come down, you know. Even Thor would make an appearance.
Yeah.
You know, after a while, I think Gummison had moved to San Diego, and Gummison was just coming kind of a regular. So we had a good local player base, and I ended up just, you know, starting to travel and play throughout Northern Cal as a lower ranked rookie.
Mm-hmm.
Hemet, I remember Hemet, which was about an hour and a half north of us in San Diego. A guy named Terry Blanco. I don't know if you guys know him. He actually was doing some promoting out there, and he was the first guy in Southern California to get some of the new Tornadoes. Cause, you know, Tornadoes started taking over the tour in, you know, the mid late 80s. And they were, you know, people were getting away from Dynamo and starting to play on Tornado. And he was right. The first guy to get some Tornadoes in the area. So we all started going up on Thursday nights to Hemet and played Hemet. And that's, you know, from there I started going to more and more tournaments after the Tornado scene kind of broke out at that point.
Mm. So you were at this point starting to move up the ranks. Who were you learning from most? I mean, obviously you had Evan and you had his brother, but who are you learning from the most?
Well, So Evan was a big, obviously a big influence. He was definitely the best player in San Diego at the time. When Gummison came there, I was the annoying kid that would never take no for an answer. So I would always latch on to the guy that was probably the best player trying to learn whatever I could from him to get him to teach me or whatever. I learned a lot from Gummison. I used to go to his house and play. Mm-hmm. He had a table at his house too and practice with him pretty frequently. But those were the two guys that had the biggest, as far as top players that probably had the initial biggest influence on me. And as I progressed through my career and started getting better, then obviously my next target to be a leech off of was Todd. So that's when I kind of started following Todd around like a puppy dog at the major tournaments I was going to.
And you could do a lot worse.
Trying to learn. I figured, he's the guy. Might as well learn from the best. It worked out good. Ended up getting a great friendship out of it and win some tournaments.
Yeah. And when was the first time you encountered Mike Green?
Mike Green, probably when I went down to Florida or somewhere in the South tournament down there, or a major. I don't know. Green, did you travel past the Mississippi back then and go to some of the West Coast tournaments at all? I don't remember. Maybe one of the Vegas tournaments.
Basically, I was the guy that showed up and reminisced with old friends and got mad because I couldn't beat anybody anymore. So nobody remembers.
I think I probably met him at one of the Atlanta tournaments back when they used to have the Masters in Atlanta. I remember you used to go to that quite frequently. So I probably think that would have been where I butted heads there and met him for the first time.
We really got to know each other at the Nationals in, I think, Tampa. I think it was the Nationals.
Yeah. Yep, exactly.
So we knew each other. We kind of hung out there, and
so man, that was quite a while ago.
Yeah, a couple of years.
I mean, he didn't frequent as many tournaments as I did, but I knew he popped his head in from time to time, especially stuff in the South and in the Florida, Atlanta, or Georgia area.
Now it seems like there's a point at which and we've been told this before that. You were at one point basically a decent rookie, but all of a sudden, within 2 years, you became one of the best players in the world. What in the heck happened?
Well, so I kind of had a good in my life that happened that was actually kind of bad. So I got, I was doing whatever I could, working full time, trying to learn what I could, playing tournaments in San Diego, traveling to whatever tournaments I could in on the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when I was 21 and I was probably upper rookie, maybe amateur back then.
Okay.
I got in a motorcycle accident.
Oh.
And busted up my left leg pretty badly. And I was in a cast, a full leg cast for like, I want to say 8 or 9 months. And all I could do was pretty much sit in a bar stool and play foosball.
Jeez.
That was it. I couldn't work. I was home. I had a table at home. So as soon as I was able to sit up right long enough, I would get a stool and sit in front of my foosball table at home and practice whatever I could from that position. And then I remember after a while, I got a walking cast, but I still wasn't working. And that's when I started kind of trying to travel around.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got a not a large settlement, but I got a decent settlement out of the accident because it wasn't my fault, obviously. And
right.
And they basically used that money to fund my traveling around the United States for the next, year and a half, 2 years, going to every tournament I could possibly go to learn whatever I could. And then I actually ended up going and staying in Denver. At that time, Todd had finally had enough of me following around and we'd become friends. And I ended up going and staying in Denver and living with him for about 2 months. And back then, Denver, and even now still Denver is, but Denver's kind of a mecca of foosball. There's a ton of good players there that travel so much. And you get in there and their field of experts and semi-pros and pros and masters is thick. They have some deep talent there. And if you can go up there and win, consistently in Denver, you're doing something right or you're learning some right things. That was just, it made sense to me to to go there and learn what I could. And from that point, and from that point over, as soon as I, you know, kind of got out of Denver, that's when I think things started. That, and obviously, you know, shooting the rollover was a big factor for me. I mean,
right.
When I first started, I didn't shoot the rollover, but at that point, once I had perfected the rollover and a five bar, then I think things went really fast for me.
And you changed. It was a paradigm shift, really, when you started shooting the rollover and winning. That really hadn't occurred before in the tour, correct?
I think there were people that were shooting it. Obviously, I know Lewis Cartwright had shot it more effectively before I did. Mm-hmm. I mean, but he was one of those guys that he was good. He lived in Vegas. I don't think he traveled a lot at the time. I think he was still kind of an up and coming player at that point. There were some other players. I know John Smith had shot it. It's for fun, you know, at other times. And I saw Smith shoot it at the 91 Worlds.
Okay.
Against Lafrenière in the finals, only because, you know, he was a long term and I think his arm was getting a little wore out on his pull shot. He went to a rollover and he was successful with it. But I don't think anybody had ever taken it over as their primary shot and won with it.
Mm-hmm.
Until I did. I mean, I think I was the first guy, obviously the first guy to win a world championship with it. And I think at that point, I think it kind of opened up some people's eyes that, hey, this shot is, you know, a legitimate threat. And at the same time, I think it stirred up a lot of controversy because I remember a lot of
right.
people not being happy about it at the time.
I was one of those people.
Yeah.
Mike.
I got a quick question for you, Terry. Like, what? I understand you were in San Diego and you played, you know, with Evan and all those guys. I know all those guys. I'm sure Scott Stewart and Adrian were kind of around at that time. But, like, what was that connection? How did you wind up to that next step to, like, knowing Todd? You know, everybody knows Todd, but, I mean, actually getting to meet him. How did all that happen?
I mean, all the Northern Cal guys, basically, you know, Adrian, Thor, Scott Stewart, yeah, back then there were some other guys that played, Steve Morey, other guys that were good, and LA had some decent talent too. So, you know, those guys you just get to know by, you know, going to tournaments and making friends at tournaments like we all do. But Todd was basically, you know, he was the guy, you know, he was my mentor. He was the guy I looked to and thought, man, he's good, right? And he wins, and I want to win. So, I mean, I was the annoying kid that would just kind of hang out around him at tournaments and interject myself whenever I could. And, you know, Todd's pretty cool about talking to people and giving advice. And I soaked up whatever I could and basically just end up becoming friends out of the deal. And I think that obviously my success as a player fed into the little bit of the fact that, hey, he's like, well, you know, hey, I can play with this guy and we can win, you know, we can do good together. So I think obviously the fact that I was becoming an up and coming player had something to do with the fact that we ended up playing together. But also, I mean, when I went and stayed with him in Denver, obviously that was a big proponent of us, you know, becoming friends for all this time.
Mm.
Yeah, I know, Todd, because like 84 was like my, what I call my breakout tournament. Had a chance to play for the winners with my partner. You remember Chris Starr, Chesky?
Starr Chesky, yeah. He was who I beat in the finals in my first world title.
So we had a good run, lost meatballs to play for the winners bracket as a couple of novices, and all of a sudden Todd's hanging out with me. Even at that age, I look at him and go, you're a leech for information, aren't you? And he's like, yes.
Yeah, you never know. Maybe he was just following me around to suck up some information and try to get some tells on me. I don't know.
Well, you know, I think, well, Todd's a smart guy. I mean, he's
oh, yeah, he's a wizard when it comes.
Yeah, he's playing front and says, hey, here's a guy named Terry Moore. You know, I'll play for this guy. You know, and then, you know, of course, it goes to Rico, whatever. No, he's a genius. That's why he's well. But obviously he saw, you know, I saw it. The first time I saw you, I go, this guy's going to be deadly. Because the thing that a lot of people don't understand about Terry was he's a great singles player.
Mm-hmm.
He's fast on the rods. You know, you look at Terry's a big guy, you know, he's six, whatever. And you're like, oh yeah, well he's, you know, a stationary player. No, Terry was a great defense and a great five rod and a great five rod defense, which that's what really impressed me. Then right then I knew, even though I was kind of out of the game, he was definitely an all around player that was going to do something in the game. That's for sure.
Yeah. I mean, when I started, the rollover for me was very beneficial for the fact that I'm very mechanical. I'm not natural at anything. You get guys like Billy, you know, and some of these younger kids that do, I see like the Brandons and these guys that just do stuff naturally. I'm like, dude, I have none of that. The one, I guess the one caveat to say is I'm left-handed. So for me, learning things on the five bar and becoming proficient with things on the five bar and being stable under pressure on the five bar, I think was a lot easier than a lot of people just because I do everything, I'm left-handed, right? So for me to take that and then add in the rollover, which, you know, for me was a lot easier to become more proficient with than a pull shot, because my pull shot was horrendous when I was younger. You know, it was a good combination.
Terry, can you hear us?
Yeah, I got you.
Oh, okay, just it sounded like you disappeared for a second there. I know that Mike has been telling us some stories of the traveling, of course, back in the day. Apparently, you were one of those. Now, what was it like to get on the road and just go from place to place and just play foosball? I mean, that's not everybody can do that.
No, that was. I'm telling you, the best times of my life as far as getting out and doing things. I wouldn't trade that for anything. I mean, after winning, I was thinking, I mean, even before I won the world in 92, mm-hmm. I had, I had that settlement that I got from that accident, and I basically had used that to finance me getting to drive around and play and not have to work like so many people do at the time and just get to see the country, make friends with all the people all over the country, you know, meet new people that I probably would have never met. Mm-hmm. And then obviously when I won the 92 Worlds, I did good at that tournament overall. I think I won mixed and singles, and I think I won the winner take all draw, or I think I might have split it with Thor. I don't remember, but
okay,
I did good. I made a nice little paycheck, and I used that to, you know, buy a van conversion that I basically used to just continue the life of driving around and being a road warrior when it comes to foosball tournaments. And it was, I made some of the best friends of my life during that. And it was some of the, you know, the most fun that you could ever imagine.
I can imagine.
Well, I was 20. I'm thinking, what was I, 24 years old? I'm out living on the road, driving around playing foosball.
It's like being a rock star.
Yeah. So, rock star. Yeah, I guess. It was.
Well, that sounds great, but let's hear the journey. Because I know you started out in a little car with a bunch of people in the car, and you took off, and you guys kind of picked people up. Let's hear some of that, because that to me is awesome. That's a great story.
Well, I started off, it had to be in late 90 or early 91, probably somewhere in that time frame. It had to be 90, maybe. I had a little Toyota Tercel that got great gas mileage and was reliable. And me and Evan, trying to think who else. I don't know the original start tour date, but that's how it started off, was me and Evan. And even before that, I'd driven with some other people in a different car. But when I got on my own, was in this little Toyota, and me and Evan kind of went out, and that kind of started it, you know. And then people kept seeing us at all these tournaments, you know, driving around, meeting new people. Next thing I know, you know, I got Swan jumping in from time to time with us. I think at one point we picked up, who else did we had a bunch of people. Tom, I know Tommy had been in the car with us before I got the van.
Robert Mares too, right? You know.
Well, after I got the van, so Marius had asked, it's kind of a funny story with Marius. So Marius, you know, he was one of those guys who just wanted to get out, loved foosball, you know, die hard, wanting to play, be competitive. And, you know, he had approached me at one of the state tournaments that I was at. You know, by then people had knew that we were out driving around doing this our thing. And he said, hey dude, I want to jump in the car with you. And at the time, I think Marius was either a semi-pro. I don't know if he was a pro yet or not. I think he was still a semi-pro, but if you ever get him on, you can ask him. But he had asked to get in the car with us. And I told him, I said, look, I go, you know, we don't have a lot of money. None of us, you know, we're not rich here. Mm-hmm. And I said, look, I don't have any problems with you being on the road with us. I'd love for you to go, but you have to be able to afford, you know, going on tour and paying your share, because we were all splitting things up, you know, the costs of gas and whatever and rooms and all that between us. And at the time, he wasn't somebody who was, you know, winning a lot on tour, but he wanted to learn. And in order to learn, you got to play. So I think I remember telling him, I said, look, dude, if you get yourself a little nest egg saved up of a couple grand or something, and, you know, so you have some money to fall back on or fund your tour, by all means, you can jump with us. And I want to say within a year or two later, I think I'd already had the van at that point, because I don't think he got in the car with us. So I think it was after 92. He came up to me and goes, dude, he says, I got $5,000 saved up. I'm like, I'm in. I'm going, all right, dude. I'm like, let's go, jump in. And, you know, and he got in there with us. And the next thing you know, Mars is getting a lot better, you know, placing higher. Hell, I started playing with him at tournaments and look at him now.
Right.
Somehow you wound up, I remember for sure that it seemed like such a funny combination, because you wound up, I remember I was at a tournament, there was Spear and Tommy with you.
Man, we had one trip where I'm trying to remember. It was in the van. I don't remember where it was from. I think it was somewhere down in maybe New Orleans or somewhere down in the South, headed to Oklahoma or Texas or something. And it was me and Evan and Mares and Tommy and Liz and Swan and Russ.
Wow.
And I think even... God, who else? There was one other person. It was a full
band. Sure Spear was with you, because Tommy told me the story.
Spear was with us a couple times, so he might have been in there too. Very, very possible. We had a very full van on that 5 or 6 hour drive, whatever it was.
Man.
And it was other times where we had quite a few people like that. And they have a lot of people wanted to get in on the van, go across the country. It was good times, man.
Was there any stories you can tell us that are legal or that would be?
It's okay. Well, I can tell you
some stories about Tommy Atkinson just being a thorn in my side nonstop.
Yeah.
In what way?
All right. So let me see. This one, I think I've told this one before. So we're in Atlanta and we're there for a tournament. And a guy named Tony Hughes was a player down there in Atlanta. And I don't know what Tony did, but I know Tony loved foosball and he loved the top players. And from what I hear, he likes to, whenever the top players come into town, he likes to take them up to some of the gentlemen's pub and get them drunk and show them a good time or whatever. So he comes and we come rolling to Atlanta for a state tournament instead of playing the Friday night tournament, we end up, Tony grabs me and Evan and says, come on, we're going to this club. And I'm like, okay, let's go. So we go to this club and I literally, after 30 minutes walking into this place, I don't remember half the night. But I do remember that Tommy told me when I came back from this club to the arcade, or it was at a pool hall, the state tournament was at a pool hall. Tommy's in there playing for some guy playing pool for like $100 a ball.
Oh.
And I walk in, I'm just trashed. And I'm like, hey, what's up, Tommy? And I start grabbing the pool balls off the pool table.
Uh-oh.
And he's pissed. So it's up messing. He messes with us. So then we end up leaving. I remember this, but we end up leaving and I'm wasted and I'm basically passed out on the floor of my van. And I think Mares or one of the other guys is driving the van at this point back to wherever we're staying. And I think we're dropping off Jimmy Watkins at her house. She needed a ride. And I'm laying on the back of the van. I'm out. And Tommy's sitting in the back with about three other people. And I think Jimmy's sitting back there too. And I'm pissed at Tommy because he's been messing with me all night after this pool ball incident. And so I start trying to kick him because I think he's down behind me, right? But I don't know who's back there. And I'm kicking Jimmy Watkins, But Tommy's yelling, "Ow, Terry, quit it! Ow, quit it!" So I keep kicking Terry harder. Oh my God, that whole night he pushed my buttons all night. But it was all fun, you know. It was some great, like I said, great stories, great times. I would never trade it for nothing.
It seems like the family that is foosball, you know, it's over and over and over again. We hear the stories that people who get into this and get addicted and, of course, make it to the top of the top of the top. The thing they want to talk about most is not necessarily the playing, but about the people. They want to talk about their friends and the kinds of friendships that are formed in this family called foosball. Now, if you had never played foosball, what do you think you would have done instead?
Hell, I don't know. I mean, I think at the time, I just kept working. At the time I was out of high school, I was a machinist working in a machine shop.
Mm-hmm.
And foosball kind of corrupted my work because I didn't even have the machinist. You just had to be at work at 5 or 6 in the morning, and hell, I was up till 2 o'clock at night and every night playing at a tournament somewhere.
Yeah.
So it was kind of hard to stay awake at work. So, I mean, if I'd never found foosball, I probably, you know, might have ended up staying on that career. I mean, I don't know. I mean, not for sure. I mean, now I work with computers, and I was always a computer geek when I was a kid. So I may still have ended up where I'm at now.
Right.
But foosball, to your point, foosball definitely, I've made some lifelong great relationships that to this day, I mean, we're talking, we're coming up on 35 years now. A lot of these people that I've met through foosball that I still know and talk to frequently. I still try to go to Vegas every year, mm-hmm. even though I don't play, because it's Vegas. And that's the one time that I get to see a lot of the people that, that I don't get to see it by going on tour anymore. But, and I have people like, I still play with Billy Pappas on Xbox, you know,
once
a week.
Oh, yeah, wow.
So I keep in touch with a lot of the guys still.
Well, you do us a favor and tell Billy we'd like to have him on the show sometime.
Sure. I'll hold him to it. I'll make him do it.
Nice.
You'd be one of the few that could get him to do it. He's a tough cookie, that guy.
Yeah, he is.
I'll give it the college try and see if I can get him to do it.
You know what we could do is tell him you'll be on with him.
Yeah, that's fine. If I have to drag him on here to get him on, I'll do it.
That'd be
you
awesome.
Well, back to what you just said, Tom, though, it's funny. Like, I had just went out, you know, a few months ago, me and my wife spent 11 days out, and we went to a Portland tournament just to hang out with friends and wound up going to Larry Chesbrough's house. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen him in 30 years. And we immediately just picked up, like, right where we left off. And my friend Frank Garbulio just came to town, and I hadn't seen him in 30 years, same thing. And it's just amazing. Like, I tell people all the time, I'm so burnt out, I couldn't remember 10 tournaments I played in, but I can tell you a million stories about the friends and guys I've met and still are friends with. That's awesome, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm terrible with, you know, people ask me, well, do you remember this tournament? I'm like, no, I don't remember. I mean, I'll give you my version, and it's probably going to be wrong way or another. I know Tommy X has got a great memory for that kind of stuff, and he's always correcting me on my bad memory. But the stories that like you touched on, Mike, are stuff you just don't forget.
So we've had conversations with some other, you know, legendary players, people like Johnny Horton. One of the things that also seems remarkable is in those moments when he was playing and at his peak, every single match he played, he remembered the name of the people he played, what the score was, and you know, who obviously won or lost and why. Is that the way you looked at the game as well?
For me, it's more not. No, for sure. No, I couldn't. I have terrible recall to specifics of a match. Now,
okay.
Specific things that happened to me at, you know, certain times that had either good or bad consequences. Generally, the big losses I tend to remember more than the big wins. Obviously, the big wins, the first of them, like when me and Diaz won doubles, obviously I'll never forget that because, sure. You know, it's your first world doubles. And you, when you win it, you know, with somebody, it obviously means more than when you win it in singles. My first singles was big. I remember a lot of the details around the last two or three matches, playing Star Chesky in the finals, playing Dieter for the loser's bracket, playing Star for the winner's bracket. Those kind of things I do remember a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, some of the stuff that Tommy talks about, I'm like, dude, how do you remember all that? I mean, we've played, you know, him as well. We've played so many matches over the years in so many situations. I'm like, how do you remember that detail?
Yeah,
I can't do it.
It seems like a photographic memory almost. But
yeah, exactly. So, I mean, some of these guys, you know, I'll get people come up to you all the time and go, remember that match you played me at the 92 Worlds and this depends. I'm like, look, dude, I'm sorry, I don't remember the 92 Worlds.
Yeah.
Well, it's always easier for a guy to remember a superstar than, you know, it's not that you're being disrespectful, but you're playing.
No, I know. I don't mean any disrespect.
I love what my daughter says. My daughter says, Dad, you know what's really funny? You got it made. I go, what do you mean? She goes, you go on that show and tell stories and nobody can even, you're so old, nobody can tell you whether they're true or not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't even remember the first time I beat Todd. I mean, I'm sure that was a big thing for me, you know, because he was my mentor at that one point. But if you ask me now, I can't remember. What I do remember is like the first time I won like a major in open doubles, and that was with Eddie Gartman in 91. I think we won the kickoff, and that was a big, and I remember we played, we had to play, I don't remember if it was the Smith brothers or Viney in the finals, but I know we had to play them in either to get to the finals, one of them to get to the finals and the other one in the finals. I think maybe we played Viney in the finals. I remember I won it with a left hook. I remember that.
Left hook. But, nice.
Yeah. I don't, that's about the extent of the match.
Now there's also something that often, and I notice this too sometimes in the local DYP, there are moments when you get into what I guess you could refer to as the zone, where nothing matters. You don't hear anything around you. You have no idea of what's happening outside the table, but are so focused and are so, I guess you could say, determined to win. Have you ever had that moment where you feel like, okay, I'm in that zone and there's nothing that can get me out of it?
Yeah, but I mean, I'm sure all the top level players have experienced that. And I think you have to be, you know, to be a competitor in this game to succeed. Definitely. I mean, I do know that when I'm not in the zone, I'm definitely struggling.
Yeah, sure.
So, I mean, and it almost becomes, you know, after you do it for a while and it becomes almost kind of a routine. But the thing is, when you're not in it is when you really are aware. And it's funny you said that, because like, I remember when I went back and played a little tournament in that tournament in Atlanta last year, I was like a nervous wreck. Like, I mean, if I was practicing, I could just be doing fine. But as soon as you put any kind of pressure on me,
sure,
like I'd fall apart. It's because I haven't played under that situation in so many years that I was so used to playing for, you know, every tournament, that it really, you know, kind of was awakening to me, like, holy cow, I'm really not to the level I was before.
Yeah, right.
So.
And I mean, you being the best player in the world back in the 90s, I mean, there must have been times when you thought this just can't last. I mean, did you ever have a moment when you're at the top of the field that was there anybody in particular that you thought, you know, this person is going to take me out for good? What, you know, who would that person be?
Well, I mean, when I was early to mid 90s, I mean, there was a lot of competition at any time. There was always people that could get you at a tournament. You know, it obviously, you know, I had believed that when I went in a tournament, I was going to win it. You know, I think everybody that signs up that's a top player thinks that. There's always matchups, you know, certain players that match up well against me or match up bad against me. Mm. When I was in my prime, there was a couple key players I would rather avoid playing. Lewis Cartwright was one, just because he had a pretty good defense. I mean, we basically, I think Lou will tell you, we both didn't like playing each other. because he didn't like my five bar because I had such a good offensive five bar. And I had a pretty good defense for him. Funny story is I got that defense from his girlfriend who figured it out
his
and told
girlfriend.
Me when I played mix with her.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, we did. I think we both didn't like matching up with each other. I mean, you generally blocked me pretty good. He was a good shooter from the back, too. So he was one of the guys that, you know, I mean, I wasn't scared of him, but if I could avoid him, I would have been happy to not have to play him. One of the other guys that in doubles I didn't like his five bar defense was Scotty Weidman. Had a really good five man defense and a good offense for that matter. I mean, very smooth, you know, hard to read his five man offense. Tommy Eckerson was always somebody on five man defense that if you weren't, you know, if I wasn't at the top of my game, he could find a niche at that any particular time and get on me defensively. And he's, you know, his five bar offense is so unpredictable all the time that it makes it a little bit more difficult. So those were some of the probably the key players at the time that I can think of off the top of my head that I would have rather avoided if I had to at certain times. But as far as ending my career type of people, I mean, I don't think you ever think like that when you're in the prime of your game. You don't think that far forward.
Right.
I mean, when I got towards the end and then my game had dropped a little bit, obviously everybody scares you, right?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Now, and one of the things too about especially a weekend long tournament, there's just so much going on. And there's, of course, once you're a pro master, there's less events necessarily to play, but it's still an endurance race, don't you think?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I can remember in Kentucky tournaments in particular because they had such a good turnouts there, and because she had so many events. I mean, I remember, I don't know if we won or lost, but the super doubles for the cars.
Yes.
That she gave that me and Diaz won. I think we played the finals of that event at like 10 or 11 a.m. Monday morning after playing all night long. Like literally, you know, we were on a 36-hour run to get to the finals. So, yeah, and that wasn't the only tournament. I mean, there were many tournaments were finals, you know, open doubles, open singles finals were at, you know, 6, 7, 8 a.m. on the day after the tournament was over.
No kidding. It seems like impossible to maintain that level of energy and to win, to be at the top.
It's tough.
Yeah.
It's very tough, especially if you're the guy in the king seat. I mean, many times, you know, me and Diaz would have like, or me and singles, either way, we'd have the king seat. Because the tournament was running so long, we'd wait 10 hours to play one match.
Wow.
Right. So yeah, it gets tough sometimes.
One of the things,
so let's go back to like matchups. I just have a quick question. Like, who's a guy that because of matchups or whatever you struggle with that most people wouldn't expect you to? Like, who's that guy? Everybody's got that guy. You know, Steve Morey was Todd Lafredo's. I mean, did you have that guy that most people thought you should have pounded, but it was always a tough match?
Let me think here. I'm trying to think who I had the worst record. I mean, my record with Todd early on wasn't that good. I mean, it only got better towards the end of my career. I don't know if people would have I don't think anybody would expect anybody to pound Todd. I mean, so sure.
What I meant is, like, is there like maybe a lesser master? I don't want to say lesser, but a pro maybe that just, you know, gave you a good battle, even though you beat him, that most people.
So there was. Yeah, there was a couple guys. I mean, I remember, I think I lost a big match to a guy named Chad Whips out of California, who was he was a good, solid player and could beat anybody at any time. He was somebody I think I don't think I matched against him a lot, but he was somebody that I would, if anybody would have said anything, they would have looked like, how did you lose that? And I'm like, well, you know, the guy just played great. You can't take nothing away from somebody who plays good. Anybody can beat anybody. I think that's what makes this game so popular with the people is obviously anybody can play it for the most part. I mean, look at some of the people we have, you know, that play even down to like guys like Chris Doobie or guys like me that are huge or small or tiny, and guys that are handicapped that play, they're still competitive. Yes. Oh, so, yeah. And the thing is, anybody can beat anybody on any given day. It's not like, hey, you're never going to win. If somebody plays bad or somebody plays great and that happened to match up on the same time, you know, upsets happen all the time.
Sure. One of the things that this goes back to, the endurance race. But we were talking to Todd Lafredo the first year or so of Foosball Radio, and he was discussing the fact that a lot of tournaments where he would win, he would not eat for 36 hours. Or he wouldn't sleep for 36 hours.
I never I don't think I could do the 36 hours not eating part. I mean, right? I mean, me and Green will fall into that group. That ain't possible. But yeah. the 36 hours of no sleep, there were more than one tournaments that didn't. I mean, I don't think it was by choice. I don't think I ever, went 36 hours without sleep by choice. I think I didn't want to go to sleep because I probably didn't know when I was going to get called up, depending on how the chart played out. And the last thing you want to do is fall asleep after 24 hours and get woken up in 2 hours and have to go play a match. That's probably not good.
Not good at all. Yeah, not good at all. No, maybe he was exaggerating about 36 hours of no food, but I often wonder.
I've roomed with Todd many times throughout the years, and I can attest that I think there were times where he didn't eat. He fasted for a certain amount of time, and that's the way he played. That's the way that's what worked for him.
So I know you and Todd played together, and you had some success. Obviously, you did great with each other. But where did Bob come in? Because I could be totally wrong. You could tell me. Like, I've known Bob since 13 or whatever, 16, I don't know. But like, when did, like, it seemed like you were kind of moving up, and Bob, to us, at least in Florida, was just kind of there. He was, like, becoming a goalie, a good goalie. But how did you just say, hey, that's the guy I want to play with?
Well, I mean, so I was playing with I think I started off when I started my rise, I started playing with Eddie Gartman, and we had some success. And then as I got, I got more successful and got to be better friends, more close with Todd. And Todd hadn't had Frederico yet. So it just kind of, we played a lot of the state tournaments and a lot of the majors together, but then Todd generally early on would go with somebody else for Worlds. And so I had to find another partner for Worlds. And I'd always, watched Bobby play. I mean, I'd known Bobby, where, like I said, we're all family here. And Bobby was, even at an early age, was, an outstanding goalie. He just had all the skills that you need to be a goalie. And he was fierce. He's one of those guys that don't take no shit from nobody on the table and can't stand losing as much as I can. So I don't remember. I think what happened was, I think the final thing that happened was I was supposed to play with either Eddie or Todd or something at a Worlds, and something fell through early on. It wasn't last minute. And then I think at that point, I think I reached out to Bobby, or maybe we'd even talked about it at tournaments, say, seeing when we need to try a tournament together or something. And I don't know, you'd have to ask Bobby, because like I said, my memory of this stuff is terrible. I think I ended up hooking up with him for a Worlds. And then from that, I mean, we didn't win that tournament. We were obviously probably successful, but I think from that point forward, we pretty much stuck together.
Yeah, believe it or not, I was with Bobby the first time he ever played on a tornado table at a tournament. And I was telling my buddies, I go, this guy, even at that time, which he was a Ford at the time, sort of, but anyway. But I said, this guy is going to wind up being one of the best goalies on tornado. And they're like, why do you say that? And I go, first of all, he has no fear. He doesn't understand how big this hole is. And this is coming from our dynamos, And I said, just his attitude and just the way he's picking up this game and his defense he's using. I'm a goalie. I may not win anymore, but I understand. And I said, this guy was going to wind up being a top player on this table. And, well, enough said there. I mean, look where he's at. But,
Mm-hmm. When it comes to goalie skills, Bobby has no weakness when it comes to goalie. He does everything right. You know, he keeps the ball in his area. He clears the ball. He scores. He's probably one of the best goalies at screwing with people's heads when you're trying to score on them and just making the hole, like you said, look huge when it's really not. And he's fast. You know, he's really fast to like a race bait situation. He just doesn't have any weaknesses in his goalie game at all. And he's super solid everywhere. And he doesn't, the pressure, he's one of those guys, and that was the reason I like him. He's one of those guys who, you know, I remember when we were in the finals one year, and this was after we were being dominant on the doubles tour. You know, we were winning a lot of the tournaments in doubles, and we got in the finals. I don't know if it was the Worlds or a major. Was it a big tournament? And just the overwhelming majority of the crowd was against us. Like, yeah. You know, people were rooting for the underdog. And Diaz is over there just loving it when they cheer against us. He's just loving it, you know. He's just like eating it up. He's like, this is the best, dude. The more people that root against us, the more I want to stick it to him. I'm like, all right, let's do it, man. So he has no chinks in his armor when it comes to playing goalie, that's for sure.
It's funny you should say that. I know that Johnny Horton and Mike Green, when they played together, Mike, all he had to do to get Johnny playing was to get him mad. Tell him something, make him mad.
And well, I think it's a lot to do with Florida and how people played. Like Bob came in 13 or 14 and we beat him like a drum, you know, but he wanted to learn, you know, so it was, you know, you had to play 5 or 10 a game. And Bobby did. You know, and the same thing with me when I had to play 5 or 10 a game against the guys, you know, so it's that bringing up in Tampa, that fearless, you know, that beat down, like, you know, they don't cut. Liz used to say, Mike, you were mean to me. I go, no, you were a player. We treated you like a player. Everybody got treated like a player, you know.
Equally.
Like, I would go to tournaments and Johnny'd say, you know what? I can't even run my mouth around you because you love it. You love to be the villain, you know.
Exactly, yeah.
And it was funny because. You know, I came back and played a couple of years ago, first time in 25 years, and I actually did pretty good in a tournament. And Tony's actually on the mic, says, look at Mike, it's Meatball, the guy he played in 25 years, and he's talking smack. These are the guys Bob learned from, and he's laughing, you know. Now, Bob took it to a next level, maybe, but I think that has a lot to do with the Florida thing, and just Bob's personality in general. The guy plays golf against professionals. He plays the best at everything to become the best. Mm. Right now, he's like the club pro. You know,
is he really?
Yeah,
club pro.
He's. I'll tell you. You know, it's funny. I got a good story for you, Green. Here about. I don't know if you're terminal about Diaz. So this is not when Diaz is playing goalie. So this was at a Kentucky State, I think, or one of the big Kentucky tournaments, and me and Diaz obviously were playing together at the time, but we ended up having to play each other. I don't know if it was the finals, but it was deep in open mixed, and he was playing forward. And I don't remember who he was playing with, but I know I was playing with Cindy Head. Mm. And I remember Cindy was getting on him, right, blocking him. And, you know, Cindy, she won't take no crap either. She's going to speak her mind the same way. And, you know, Diaz, you know, he's up there too, and she's getting on Diaz. I remember one time she blocked Diaz a couple times in a row. And after like the third or fourth time, I think she blocked the ball off the table and she stopped and she opened up her pocket and looked down her pocket and goes, is that you down there, Bobby? That's the one time I see Diaz just like really crazy. I don't think he liked that one bit. I kind of saw, hey, I think that one might have got him.
And it's funny because if you remember later on when he was winning, he was the one looking at his pocket. If you remember, like,
yeah, exactly, yep. Well, that was one.
Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say that was one of the few times he was playing forward then, obviously not goalie, but. That was one of the few times I looked at him like, man, she got you good there. And he didn't have to come back.
Now, I'm going to say this, and I hope that Terry doesn't mind. He's heard this boring story before, but I just love it. It was him and Bob were number one, came to Florida State, me and Johnny. Johnny's like, let's play. I go, I don't play foosball. And I said, I'll play as long as I can drink heavily, and I don't care what happens. He goes, fine. So we actually, if I, and this is my memory, you can correct me, but we beat you guys the first out of the losers. And the whole time, Bob is squealing and yelling, and he's like, Green, you're cheating. And finally, at the second set, Terry says, Bob, you're messing with me. Time out, Bob. He's not cheating. What is going on here? What, I've never seen anybody get in your head like Green. What is, he goes, he's cheating. He goes, he's not cheating. And Bob says, he is. He taught me how to cheat. I know.
I remember. I do remember that tournament.
Of course, they wanted to win the match anyway, but it was a lot of fun. We had a blast. Everybody but Bob had fun.
Yeah, we always, whenever we played Florida guys, it was always, I mean, we used to match up against Star a lot and all those guys. Yore, we played Tom Yore at a lot of tournaments. You know, right. Anytime we played up against Florida guys, it was always at another level.
It seems like Florida and Colorado, the two states, and I guess a bit of Texas and California, have really been the hotbeds for many decades now when it comes to the best players. Would that be true?
Yeah, that, I mean, I would throw Dallas in there. Dallas has got Houston has got a lot of players, kind of the same Colorado, at least they did back then in the 90s. They have the same syndrome of guys that just didn't travel on tour, but they had such a good player base locally that, you know, you had guys, you go down to Houston, you know, Smith brothers were down there. John didn't really travel that much. He would go to the Worlds, but if you went to Dallas, Houston, you were going to play him at a tournament, him and his brother.
Sure.
I mean, Tracy McMillan, his brother, Sean McMillan, there's plenty of guys. I mean, I know Bill Bell came out of Houston. There's a lot of good players that came out of Houston that Carl were Peterson. Guys that you had to worry about, you know. Dallas too. Dallas had a ton of good players. I can think. I remember there was a guy that people always, you know, talk about, one of the best long pull shots ever, and a guy that people haven't heard, but all the Dallas and Houston players know him. A guy named Hossein Kiani. I mean, Jesus, this guy had the fastest dead man long I'd ever seen, and he played locally just in Dallas. He never traveled, and he was a good player, good five. He was strong. I think like 91 or 92, he had to match up against Todd early on in singles, and he beat Todd early on in one of the rounds. So they had lots of guys like that in Dallas too, you know?
Yeah, it just seems like that's those states especially. So most recently, I'm sure you're aware that the Tony Spraderman has left the mix. He's now in Europe. We had this discussion before, but I'm curious about how you feel about it when it comes to someone like Tony, who's so dominating. Leaves a scene like the American Tour. What happens to the other players? Is it a situation where the players that are left behind have an easier time of winning, or is it still a crapshoot?
Well, obviously, I mean, if you just look at the results from the last 10 to 15 years, I mean, it's pretty much Tony in singles.
Yes.
So I don't think it'll make things more difficult. If anything, it's going to give other players a chance to win, but it's also going to take a little bit away from everybody else's learning knowledge. Obviously,
yes.
You know, one of the challenges about getting good is playing better players, and you don't get better unless you play people that are better than you
or the best.
So, I mean, I think that's been a big. I mean, you get Billy on here to talk with me about it. I don't know if I can get him on, but if I can, he'll tell you right away that the talent pool is not as deep as it used to be. Not that any of the players that are playing now are not spectacular and great players.
Sure.
But the sheer number of very talented top level pros players that are playing nowadays is not nearly as many as there was in the mid 90s when Tornado was really booming. You know, you had a lot of good players, and anytime you lose top level players, you lose something for everybody, right? Sure. Everybody suffers. Everybody takes a little bit of a hit when good players leave. So I as far as Tony leaving, I think Europe is going to get a lot better a lot faster.
Sure. Oh yeah.
Now we have, you know, somebody of Tony's level playing, you know, playing with them regularly, and Tony's going to get a lot better on other tables now that he has, you know, has exposure to play on those other tables. And people over here, hopefully, you know, it'll give some other people some chances to win some titles. But in the big picture, I mean, it's definitely a loss for the players in the United States.
No doubt. Yeah. For the spectators, especially the fans.
Yeah. Obviously spectators too. I mean, but for the other competitors,
I have a little different opinion about that. I agree with everything you said about competitive and Tony's the best, and I just think that he's been winning so long that he's just kind of crippled the open events. And I understand if you're the best, you should be the best. You should win. All I'm saying that it was his choice to leave, and I'm a Tony fan, right? He's been living in Florida the last quite a few years. But what I'm saying is I think it will bring out more people to the open events to make them bigger, to make them play harder. Then, and it absolutely will be, you know, there's always going to be an asterisk because you think about Michael Jordan, but he left at the end of his career. Tony left in the middle of his prime. You know, he's a guy still winning. But as far as just drawing bigger tournaments, crowds, and more open players, I don't think it's a horrible thing. And I know that's kind of like an excuse. Like it sounds like, well, but you know what? You ever watch two boxers that are like 10, 18, and 2, and they match up good together? It's a great fight. It's a lot of fun to watch, you know?
There might be some of that. I'm sure there's players out there that will think, you know, I don't have to play against Tony now, so maybe I'll go and I can win and bring in some prize money. But I tend to look at let's do a comparison of Federico. Mm-hmm. So I mean, Federico in Europe was dominating. Like he didn't not win almost every tournament he played within Europe, and here as well, he would come over here and win, just not as much. But when it came to Europe, he won everything there was to win on every table in Europe, and the sport grew over there. And I'm not as in tune with what's going on. Obviously, I haven't been out of the picture, and I'm not watching it. But to me, it just seems like the sport has in Europe is not growing as fast as it was when he was playing. Mm-hmm. So and he's been retired pretty much for what, at least 6 or 7 years now. I mean, he hasn't played in any that I know of in the last 7 years. So. Yeah. I tend to think that when those type of players leave, I think the sport in general suffers.
Well, I believe that the last few years, just because I kind of been keeping track of it, that, I mean, well, of course, Europe compared to America is still leaps and bounds ahead in what they're doing and how with the leagues and people playing. And but I don't disagree with what you said, but I don't know. I don't know what's happening. I mean, my personal opinion, American foosball is, people win when they're out playing the game, and I think people have gotten lazy here, and they figure, oh, I could just go win, and they show up, and that's why, look what just happened in Vegas. Like, most of the teams that won in the top 10 were from other countries,
mm-hmm.
because guys are showing up, not playing locally, not playing in these tournaments, they show up at the big ones, and they, you know, have some drinks, and then and play recreational foosball, and now some of these Europeans are starting to hand it to them, you know, and... how that works out.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that kind of goes back to the whole, I mean, tour in general. There's just not as many tournaments now as there used to be. Like when I was in the van, when I was touring around, I was at like a 5 grander or bigger every weekend, probably 40 weeks out of the year.
40 weeks.
I mean, I could literally drive to, you know, a 5 grander or bigger pretty much every weekend, and we did. And there was a lot of foosball being played, and the field of players, I think, was bigger mm-hmm. back then than it is now. And to your point,
no
Mike,
I agree.
I think the U.S. in general has lost a competitive edge as far as just the sheer amount of players and tournaments being played.
Yeah, it's inevitable. If we don't have newer players coming up, and we do have some really talented kids coming up, there's no doubt about that, but it's just not the volume. You see, like an example would be Germany. Germany, in every office, every corporate office, there is a foosball table, at least one.
It definitely comes to their culture there. I mean, obviously there's soccer. I remember because I've been in Europe and played many tournaments. I went over and stayed with Federico. I mean, I'm very close with Federico and his family. And and I've been privy. I mean, like at one point, I don't know if it's still that way, but I remember Ingrid's father, who was big into foosball even then, and they played the leagues, the Belgium.
Yes.
National league that they play with league nights or whatever had 10,000 active members.
Wow.
Right. And that's just leagues. Those are people that are just playing for fun. They're not competing at tournaments mm-hmm. and they've got 10,000 players in that little country playing in leagues. I mean, we don't have 10,000 players in the United States
no.
playing anywhere, right?
Not even close.
So
I think it goes back to just their culture there is much more accepting or craves foosball because of the soccer tie-in.
Oh yeah, I don't know. There's no question. There's a connection. I mean, you go to a professional soccer game, or if, no, I guess you could say football game, in the stadium, they have foosball tables. So it right. goes hand in hand, and it makes sense. And there's you know, people on those tables at all times. So it makes to me, I think. This side of the pond, we have things to think about and things we have to talk about in forums or whatever the case, just to figure out what to do to bring more people and make it more accessible. There's certainly some great ideas that have come from people like John O'Brien from Foosball Clubs USA, but you know it seems like it's been difficult. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think a lot of the problem is just the venues. They don't have a lot of places that tables are accessible.
Yes.
And I've heard about the gentleman you mentioned doing the Foos Clubs USA and going into schools and getting into schools. I think that's phenomenal. If he can have more success in that arena to get the kids access to tables where they're at, you know, most of the day, that's a huge start to hopefully build a new player base.
Yeah, there's some great success stories. I know that John, who passed away this last year, Mark Jolette, who took over from him, has in his school district alone 70 players in middle school. 70.
Awesome.
And they
that's awesome.
They play on a regular basis, and you know, before COVID, they were getting out and touring around in a junior league, which I thought, man, that's where it all starts. That's where the fever kicks in. That's where the kids get addicted and step into bigger and bigger boots.
Yeah, that's when I mean. Obviously, when I got addicted, I was that age, but I had an arcade that had them. And
yeah.
Those avenues just aren't around anymore, so it makes it harder for people to get exposure to it. Most of the kids that you see coming up now that are good, like I see the Brandon. And his whole family played, and
yes.
generally they're children of players that played in the previous generation. Even Billy, you know,
sure.
Tony as well. Tony's dad played, so you know.
Yeah, there's a few, and it seems like the ones that are at the top are those second generation kids that were exposed at an early age to the sport, and which is great. It's just now we got to find some kids that are just getting into it, and their family maybe had no idea that they would be good or it would be a fun thing to do. So, you know, as time goes on, hopefully we can come up with some more ideas. So, Terry, I'm wondering when it comes to you know, the future of foosball, what do you think? What do you think this sport could be in 5 years?
I mean, I'm not as in touch with what's going on as I used to be. Obviously, when I played, I don't really have the pulse of what's going on as far as who's promoting and doing what. I do hear stories out of places that have some stuff, you know, changes and things that are doing as far as tournament styles. I know that, like, I think I've heard that the Texas State, they've changed the Swiss system. I don't know if that's the end all changes to what's going to happen. I think, you know, everybody was excited with the whole ITSF thing. I don't think that has turned out to be quite what they had anticipated it to. I know it's still pretty heavy and going on, but I think that they've lost a little bit of the desire of the top players to play on their formats or their world stages now. I remember when we first went to the first World Cup, it was, you know, it was hardcore. I mean, you were going, there was no money, and you were hardcore going at it in the first World Championships by ITSF. Same thing, you know, there was some money to play and the top players were playing. And now, I mean, I don't really know who's the top players in Europe and that is, but I talked to Billy and he keeps a little bit more in tune of what's going on where, and he has, you know, he's told me that the playing field, the depth of the player there is, you know, obviously Federico quit going a long time before they stopped having tournaments, and a lot of that stuff's falling off. So I don't know where they are and how it's growing, but I have seen some things. I know that one of the things I did see that I noticed was the Colorado State, how they started doing some sort of like sponsorships where you could sponsor an event Like, you know, if you want to sponsor an event and have your name attached to that event. I thought that was a really cool idea. I thought that somebody had, I can't believe somebody hadn't thought of that sooner, that to get more money into the event, to obviously, you know, money is going to mean more players for the most part, you know, more when there's, you hear somebody's playing for $20,000, you know, people tend to perk up and want to go take a shot at it. So, but I mean, if you follow the trend, to me, from 15 years out looking, I haven't seen a lot of growth from my perspective of things changing. And I don't have the answer of where it's going to go. I would hope that, you know, things that, like you guys are doing with the internet and things being more readily accessible and people able to stream matches online and stuff to get the exposure out there. I mean, that's obviously an avenue that I think should be heavily utilized, and hopefully, you know, the right people see the right things, and who knows where it goes from there.
Yeah, media attention, getting the word out. That's a huge part of what happens within any sport. Take a look at what's happened to pickleball.
Here's one better. Pickleball. How about what's the other one? Freaking
cornhole.
The cornhole. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Come on. Play for $50,000.
It's crazy.
What's good is in Florida, we actually have a South Florida Foosball Club, it's called. It was a bunch of guys who went and had beers and started playing foosball together. And now they've been around a couple years. Like I said, I hadn't played 25 years. And Mark Torres says to me, "Hey, there's this Thunderdome tournament coming up. You should go play." And I go, "You got the wrong number. You know, like, who are you talking to?" You know? And he's like, "No, really, man. It's an expert tournament. You're an expert now." And I go, "Why would I want to go play an expert tournament?" He says, "Because it's called the Thunderdome. It's a Swiss system. They're only going to have 64 players, and the entry fee is $350 a head. It's going to be at least a 20 grander." So I'm like, wait a minute. Grand. There's no pros and no masters. And he's like, "Yeah." And I go, "I don't believe it." So I check into it. Sure enough, it wound up being a 20. They had a cow cut and everything. It wound up being a $20,000 expert tournament with 64 players.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So, so I got to know the guys, right? And I actually did good. I actually won two events and wound up got third overall in an expert event. In this day and age, I won $2,000. You know, I felt like I was a millionaire. You know?
And unheard of.
So I got to know these guys a little bit. So now we all 10 of us went in and bought tables, and we're starting a Florida tour. We're gonna have like 8 tournaments a year or whatever. And I hope Tommy doesn't mind me saying that, but it is what it is. But we're gonna wind up having all these different tournaments. I don't want to get in too much into it, but basically you can come to Florida about every 2.5 months and play a tournament. It's probably gonna be a $15,000-$20,000 tournament.
So are they all, is it an expert tour or is it an open tour?
No, it's going to be everything. The first one was just an expert, like a little test. There's a lot going on, and definitely going to be a master's, you know, like a pro master event. And, but I mean, like to have that, just, that's just one person. And there's a person in Seattle. I don't never know how to say his name.
David Culler.
And, he's got some things going on, and they're doing, I mean, right now, honestly, Seattle, Portland area now in Florida, kind of like, it's really the reason that Steve Murray decided to have the Swiss in Texas State.
Open doubles.
Because everybody just loved it. Everybody was, you know when you're going to play, and I know there's, you know, the more I play, I know there's goods and bads, but I don't want to sit around for 8 hours and play a match, you know, before I play a match.
True. Yeah, I agree. I mean, anything to schedule out tournaments to make the player experience more pleasant, I think is a good start for sure.
Yeah, we started at 3:00. The first night we were done at 11:00. The second night we were done at 9:30. And the finals were over completely done Sunday at 9:45 p.m. We were all looking at each other. We didn't know what to do. We had no idea. We had too much time on our hands.
Wait,
like, well, what do you do now? They go, "Well, let's actually have a conversation." Like, no. But anyway. But here's a question I like to ask people, Terry, and I know that you would never take offense to this because it's not meant in any kind of offense, but, you know, I always say that there's a time in history when, you know, Furry Wiswell, you Diaz, you know, whoever, where a team comes together and becomes, I call, the super team. You know, the team that's going to win, and they're going to have an incredible winning record like you and Bob did. So my question always is like, I know you're a great singles player, and I know you won a ton of singles events, but Terry Moore have been Terry Moore without Bobby, Bobby without Terry, kind of, you know, do you understand what I'm trying to say? As far as
where would you have been if we never teamed up? Is that what you're getting at?
Well, what I'm getting at is like, do you feel like he was your guy? Obviously, could you have done that with Todd? You know, I don't know. Or
No. Bobby was definitely my guy. Mm. I mean, me and Todd played great together, and we were successful, and we played basically after, you know, me and Diaz stopped playing, then me and Todd kind of picked up. But I mean, me and Bobby's my guy. I mean, there would have never been the team that we were without each other. I think we complemented each other perfectly at the time that we needed, and, you know, just everything clicked. I mean, it was one of those things that was meant to be, I think, and it ended up being the best possible, you know, scenario that could have come out of it. And I wouldn't, there's nobody else I would have rather played with at that time in my life, for sure. I mean, me and Bobby, you know, we still talk now, but we're tight, and, you know, going through that whole experience together and being that team, and all, like I said, all of the things, winning our first doubles together, you know, going through, you know, crowds that hated us together, all that kind of stuff that I mentioned is all awesome. You think about it now, it's just like, you know, it's the stuff that you remember, not the actual details, the overall things of us going through the thick and thin of everything.
So I figured that's exactly what you were going to say, but I always like to ask the question, because one of the things was, like I said, you know, it just always seems like whatever era it is, two guys for whatever reason seem to come together, and it's like almost meant to be.
Mm-hmm.
And they become that team that plays. They know how they each play. I mean, you can bring the two number one and two player together in the world all year long to play together. It doesn't mean they're going to play good. You know that. It's like when
matches
up and becomes the team.
No, I totally agree. Chemistry is a huge part of every team. And I mean, me and Diaz were more dominant as a team than me and anybody else. And I'd probably say the only other, and the biggest reason, I think the reason that we stopped playing together was not because of Diaz, was because of me and my skill level and my, you know, my whole mental approach to the game and where I was at in the game had definitely fallen off, and Diaz hadn't. You know, he still wanted to win. He had more, you know, urge to be dominant. And if you look at just after that, you know, he grabbed Ryan Moore, and look what they did. You know, he took another person, and they turned into another super powerhouse dominating team. So yeah, it's definitely, you know, our time together was the time that it, you know, was perfect for us. And I have no, you know, ill will feelings or anything towards him about not playing together anymore. It was just time for us to split up, because I think he had more desire to do great things in the game, and my lack of it affected my game too much. And he's proved that he's, you know, he's the greatest goalie of all time. I still think that he's the greatest goalie of all time. I don't think you're ever going to find too many people that can say Bobby's not the best goalie in the game of a game of foosball.
I think you just came up with a new topic for us. We've done the top 50 players in foosball, the top 25 singles players, and now the top goalies. I like that idea.
Yeah, that would be a good one to do.
Yeah.
It's a spoiler, though. We already know who's going to be the number one spot.
Harry, I'm blushing. Come on, stop.
Well, there has to be a vote. It could be Mike Green. You never know.
Mike Green might fit somewhere on that list. Green's so super slouch, man.
Yep.
All right, so here's my next thing I want to ask you, Terry. As you know, we've had this conversation privately. I've always said that in my time, and I've been around since Moses, I wasn't around in the early 70s, but I've been around a long time, and I always said that there's like three, maybe four players or teams that have changed. I mean, they changed the way the game was played.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, in the 1990s, whatever, I don't know when exactly, but when you came in and took over, you became that guy. And when you and Bob teamed up, you guys became that team. And my personal opinion is, like, Bob was like number 22 in the top 50, and I don't know where you fell. Somewhere in the top 10, but I always felt like you guys never got the respect you were due. Now, I'm not trying to start trouble. I'm just saying, in my personal opinion, and I know you may not want to answer this question, but you've already answered about Bob. Where would you, how do you feel about what I just said, and where were you in that category in your own opinion? Where did you fit in that top 10, say?
Top doubles teams for me and Diaz?
Or both. Maybe for you and then just the top. I'm just talking about individuals. Like, Bob is a goalie. And
I think the number one doubles team has to be Federico and Todd. You can't argue their statistics. I mean, it's ridiculous how many tournaments they won, how many worlds they won together, and the dominating. I mean, every time they played. And I think I know that, you know, Tony's definitely in the top two for greatest singles player. I mean, it's going to become between Freddie and Tony, depending on, you know, what your opinion is, everybody's opinion in. For me, I mean, I might be a little biased because Federico is a friend of mine. Not that Tony's not. I mean, Tony is amazing, and the record that Tony has in singles is amazing. But I think if you throw in the multi-table factor for Federico, the fact that he dominated for as long as he did on 10 different tables, something like that, ridiculous. I mean, it makes it hard. Now, not to say Tony may change that, right? Because now Tony is in Europe playing. He could very well just, you know, stomp all over that. You know, pick up the skills he needs over there. I mean, he's definitely got the desire. And I think part of him being over there is for him to give him another challenge to do something different on a different table. Because I know that he's been so dominant here in the United States. So who knows where that is going to go. For me in singles, there's so many good players. I mean, personally, I think Tommy is a better straight out singles player than I am.
Really?
If you look at just his singles game, the fact that the way he plays, I think Tommy is a better singles player than I am.
I think I think Tommy ended up, at 9 and you at 4.
Yeah, Tommy is, I don't know. I don't remember the whole list. I think they had a mixed in of men and women in that list. So I'm going to stick with just men. I just don't see how Tommy is the ninth best singles player of all time. But well, I didn't get to see some.
I'm just saying overall skill level play, like where would you rank yourself in the top 20?
I would put me and Diaz for doubles. Probably top 3 or 4, just because we had such a long dominating, you know, I mean, basically we were
your record
pretty strong for close to 10 years. I'm a better part of 8 to 10 years.
Yeah.
I don't, aside from, I know that Diaz and Ryan had good runs and doubles as far as stuff. I know some other players, but I don't know the stats, but I mean, obviously if you're asking me, I'm biased. So I'm going to say, I think me and Diaz put in there for the top 3 or 4 somewhere. Me in singles.
No, you just overall. Like, not doubles or singles, just overall top 50. Where do you put yourself amongst all those guys for everything, your game period, all events?
I gotta feel like I'm somewhere in the top 5.
Yeah.
Somewhere in there. Somewhere six and five, somewhere in that range, maybe.
I agree with that.
Absolutely. You know, I got to feel like me personally, I have so many players that I looked up to that I think were amazing. It's hard for me to even put myself there because I think of guys like most people don't think of, like, you know, there's certain people you ask, like Todd will say, like Spear was an amazing singles player. I mean, he didn't have a strong goalie game, but he was so fluid up front. He made him tough to beat, you know, but he wasn't known for being a singles player, but I still think he was good. You know, Bacon was
Tony
on Dynamo. He was so good in singles because he was so dominant up front. You know, he passed and scored all the time. So he didn't have he wasn't known for his goalie game, but his forward game was so strong it made his goalie game that much better.
But the thing about his goalie game was he was doing already doing the 2-5 to his 5-rod back then, which that nobody was doing, and that really made him dominate.
True. Yeah, he was. Anyway, there were so many people
on the spot. I just like to ask people, like, you know, where they fit in, because a lot of times I think, you know, like I told you in our little preview thing we did, I was surprised when I started thinking about how long ago you left the game. And like,
I was talking to somebody after you asked me that the other day, and I was thinking, man, it's been more than 15 years.
Yeah.
I don't know you. 2007, maybe 2008 was probably the last tournament. I don't know, what year was that Hawaii tournament that Mary had? I think that was probably my last tournament.
I don't know
what year that was. I was already petering off before that, but I think that was my last big one I went to.
I think the last thing that I saw as far as IPF was around 2007.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Hmm. I think it's been about 15, 16 years since I've played competitively. Yeah, it doesn't seem like it's been that long, but it has been. We're getting old, Green.
Yeah, I got a long time.
Oh, come on now.
All right, so
what does that make me, ancient? I mean, come on. Hey.
Yeah, you're just a little younger than me, Tom, but. So, Terry, I guess what I'd like to say is what would you like to talk about that we haven't talked about? Is there anything that you would like to let's hear from the man himself? That's why you're on here.
Yes, your chance.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I've kind of listened to a few of the episodes in the past when you've had people on that have talked, you know, that have interested me to listen to. I know my name has been brought up many times when people have described certain situations they went in. A couple come out to mind. I think with Trevor, you guys asked something about Trevor, and I remember him. He called me and told me afterwards that he said something. And I think I've come across as, and I won't come across. I mean, I was an asshole when I played a lot, right? I mean, and I think it just goes back to, you know, I don't think people thought like that was my job. That was what I did. And my competitiveness was obviously off the chart, and I didn't like losing. I really can't stand losing.
Yeah.
And I think I just was protective of giving out any information. You know, you talk to, you know, you'll hear some of the guys talk like Spear. Oh my God. He had notes that would just to die for if you could get a hold of them, books full of notes. And you wouldn't give that kind of information out. So I know that when I played and when I was competitive, I was not there to when I was playing in a match, obviously we're all friends, right? But when I'm in a match, I'm not there to make friends. I'm there to win. And I think that's what I liked about Diaz when we played is he's not worried about making friends in the match. He's worried about winning. So, you know, I think that I've gotten a couple people pissed off in the years, but it is what it is. I mean, now I'm out of the picture and I've had time to think about it. Probably did some shit when I was playing that was kind of a jerk, but you know, I wouldn't trade nothing at this point.
No regrets. No, it's interesting because it's still, you know, it's subdued. You don't see as much trash talking and that kind of thing. But even more recently, I've seen a couple of moments where you know, the intensity between a couple of players, speaking of which would be recently it was Tony Spraderman versus Brandon Munoz. And there was an obvious violation. There was a foul on the table, and Tony is trying to, you know, say, hey, you know, at least admit it. And of course there was an argument that went on. So I think it's because of that intense competition. Now they don't hate each other, but at that moment it seemed like they're definitely at loggerheads. And that makes sense. Well, if you're that competitive.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's like, I mean, I remember talking to Trevor and he talked to me after the fact, and it was more of a statement. I don't remember the exact statement of you guys that are you, but it was more of a, like, he had asked me for some advice or something after he had played me and lost, I think.
Okay.
And I was not going to give him any advice for two reasons. One is I don't want to give my competition any insight on how to beat me. Right.
Sure.
I mean, I know that sounds horrible, but if you really think about it, I mean, I don't need somebody else out there that can beat me more. And two, I think at that point, Trevor was an up and coming player.
Mm-hmm.
And he was somebody that I looked at like, you know what, if this guy gets really good, he could be somebody that could, you know, potentially keep me from winning tournaments. And I don't know, I guess looking back on it now, it probably wasn't the best, but I wasn't there to help anybody beat me. That's the way I look at it.
Any sport,
yeah, I don't
like
make
that.
Any apologies. In the 70s and 80s, you didn't tell anybody anything, period. Yeah. You know, because we were on the road like you, and in the 90s, you took that over, and you were one of the few people. And I've told people in the past, when I would lose a match, I felt like somebody just took the most important thing in my life away from me. Mm-hmm. You know, and it really would just make me crazy. Like, I was just like Bob. You know, but now when they just sit there and they have a conversation right after the match, and I've said this 100 times, but I need a few minutes. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, don't bother me.
I'm right there with you, Green. I'm the worst loser. Like Bobby actually is one thing I give Bobby credit for is his sense he is. He can lose a match and it'll bother him for a little bit, but he's generally over it pretty quickly. I'm not so much, especially if it's a big match. I remember one of the first Worlds I got to after I'd already won and when I was expected to win, and I think we lost to Frederico in the finals, and man, it was a week. I mean, I was a good solid week where you just didn't want to be around me. I held that shit for a while. Yeah. So I was definitely a very bad loser. I was a very bad loser for sure.
Well, the thing I give you a lot of credit for though was you took a lot of these guys. Robert being on the road with you after a couple of years, he became the guy to beat. I mean, he actually, mm-hmm. you know, he was one of the guys to beat, and it was because he went on the road with you and these guys. So there's also a lot of credit needs to be, you know, given to you for what you did, because people just didn't do that. You know, everybody says there's a guy, Kenneth Dale in pro, wins all the pro events, and Tony wins all the opens, and everybody goes, how do these guys do it? I go, because they're the only two full-time players. Yeah. Ken does it in pro, Tony does it in open, because nobody's a full-time player anymore, which for obvious reasons, you know, there's no money to become a full-time player anymore. But.
Well, the only other full-time player and then it's showing is Brandon Munoz, right? Like he's going out and playing full-time, you know, so, and he's the guy to beat. And to your point, Green, is that that's what it, I mean, to get to the levels that Tony and Brandon Munoz and even myself, we got to, you have to. If you look at all the guys, Horton, I mean, all those guys, Beer, Todd, all the guys in the 70s, 80s, even some of the guys in the 90s when I was playing, all the top players, for the most part, are all, I should say, the people that rose above the game and became, you know, super players, if you want to call them that.
Right.
All lived this. This was their job at some point. This was what they did. They didn't have, you know, they didn't have a job they had to do. They lived foosball.
You could use use the term legendary status for sure. You know, those are legendary status, like yourself.
Yeah. What I think about when I hear people talk about sharing information, I think about the Bucks playing the Redskins, and coaches get together and say, hey, what's your game plan? You know what I mean? Like, it just doesn't make sense to me. That's just, maybe I'm weird like that, but, you know.
No, it does. And I, there's certain players that are don't have that approach that I have. I mean, I know Todd's very good about talking to people and teaching people if they ask. And for me, for the most part, there's a lot of stuff that I don't have a problem if you want, you know, me to help you with something or whatever. But when it comes down to like specific things for you know, about my game or something, if it's somebody that I know I'm going to have to play at a big event at the next tournament, I'm obviously going to be apprehensive about giving anything away that could be detrimental to me.
It's a living. Yeah, why would you take money out of your own pocket to do that?
Well, yeah, I mean, if foosball wasn't, for me, I think it's a different approach. If foosball wasn't, if I wasn't one of those people that was living foosball as my, you know, as my life, as my income, like Tony now, then I mean, maybe I'm not that way about it, because I have a full-time job I'm going home to. Foosball is not putting bread on, you know, not feeding or not getting me to the next tournament or whatever.
Sure.
You know, who knows how it is if I'm not that player. I mean, maybe I'm still the same way just because of my competitiveness. You know, I don't know. I see Tony win a lot. I know he doesn't like losing either. I see him get
been out of shape when he doesn't win. But I also know he's a good ambassador of sport. I've seen him be very influential in helping other players, you know, make their games better and teach them stuff. Yeah,
mostly younger players, and people who are, you know,
he's really
rookies.
Good at that. I've seen him a lot of stuff.
Yeah, but like Chad Hansen said last week, after a tournament and you're broke and you're out, you bombed out in the tournament, you're in your car sleeping in the back seat.
It's a big difference.
I don't ever think I got spoiled like that.
I think I got a skedaddle here, brother. I mean, that's been incredible. I really appreciate you coming on, Terry.
Wow.
And I've had a blast. I love hearing these stories and talking to guys like you. You know, and that were so competitive for so long, and I think everybody else definitely would like to hear it. And thanks for coming on.
Hey, man, I appreciate you guys having me on, man. It's been a blast going through all this stuff over again. And the stories, you're right, the stories are great to hear and great to tell.
And Terry, I have to say, I echo the sentiments of Mike, but at the same time, you know, it's this is an open door policy. Love to have you back anytime soon. You know, anytime you'd like to come back.
Sure, I'll stick to my words if I can get Billy to come on. And if I have to bring him on himself, I'll try to do it.
Yeah, drag.
Well, I got Billy one back. You can try to bring on. Try to get Bob to come on with you because
Bob Diaz.
Bob doesn't even do anything much for football. Get that guy on here, man.
Have you asked him to come on? He won't do it.
I've tried. I'm going to give him another shot, but Bob's Bob. He's on to his next business and. He started a golf cart business and super.
Yeah, I know he's doing really good with the golf cart
business.
He's
doing
really
well. And Bob's focused. I mean, you know, the guy, everything he touches in business turns to gold.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to give him a shout out, but maybe with you, we can, you know, get a little extra prodding in there to.
Yeah, tell him I'll come on here with him and we can go through the old times again. But I'll hit him up too.
Sounds good,
man. That'd be awesome. Well, Terry, thank you so much once again for being on Foos Talk Live. This has been episode 160. We have so much more yet to come this evening. We've got the Foos Talk Live tournament beat coming up in just a few seconds. But once again, thanks again for tuning in, Mike. Thank you so much for helping out and getting a name like Terry Moore on the show. This is an amazing thing. Thank you so much. And both you and Terry, both guys, please have a very memorable Memorial Day weekend. And thanks for joining us on Foos Talk Live.
You too, Tom. Thanks.
Foosball tournaments are everywhere. Foos Talk Live proudly presents a weekly update of events near you with the Foos Talk Live Tournament Beat. Here's what's up. The Canadian Pro Tour by Canada Foosball presents... The Edmonton Foosball Championships, June 16th through the 18th. Edmonton Foosball Club, Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. The Toronto Foosball Club presents the Tornado Foosball Tournament, July 14th through the 16th. Toronto Foosball Club, Toronto, Ontario, Canada. It's the 2023 Beachtown Beatdown, July 21st through the 23rd at Lake Worth Beach, Florida. The 2023 National Championships and North American Cup, July 26th through the 30th at the Crown Plaza Denver Airport Convention Center, Denver, Colorado. It's the Bardo Hearn Celebration Foosball Tournament, August 17th through the 20th at the Kalahari Resort, Round Rock, Texas. Make your plans now for the 2023 Tornado Championships, August 30th through September 4th. Clarion Hotel, Lexington, Kentucky. Each week, we do our best to give you the most up-to-date listing of foosball tournaments near you. If you have an event you would like to add, send us all the details at info@foosballradio.com. Tune in every week for the Foos Talk Live Tournament Beat. Foos Talk Live is a product of Foosball Radio. With gratitude, we recognize our Foosball Radio Patreons. Our Foos Talk Live sponsor, original-leonhardt-usa.com. And thanks to InsideFoos.com for use of their audio during the show. Tune in again next week for another episode of Foos Talk Live. In the meantime,
we'll see you at Foos.